prisons. At the same time, a similar event took place in the Gaza Strip against the Palestinian Hamas movement. The position of Saudi Arabia and some Arab countries during the days of the war was very hostile towards the resistance groups. Egypt, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia were serious critics of Lebanon's Hezbollah and accused it of adventurism, which its Secretary General Syed Hassan Nasrallah responded to in the very first days of the war. Israel, which had ended all previous wars by occupying parts of the Arab lands, failed in this war and did not achieve any of the goals announced in the early days of the war, an issue that even many Zionist leaders acknowledged. The end of the war in Lebanon and the Gaza Strip was a new era in the struggle against Israel, which was met with the sympathy of many Islamic nations and even some non-Islamic countries. After the end of the 33-day war, a fact-finding committee was tasked with examining the performance of the Israeli cabinet and army in the war. According to their report, named the Vinaigrette, then Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert was announced as the culprit of Israel's defeat in the war and its failure to destroy Hezbollah, which was one of Israel's main goals on the first days of the war. Several attacks of the Zionist regime on the Gaza Strip in the following years and the resistance of Palestinian groups in the region had similar results for the axis of resistance. Saudi Arabia saw that Iran had found a decisive role in an important issue such as Palestine and, of course, was victorious in the field of Palestine. During these years, Saudi Arabia publicly expressed concern about the victories of Iran and its friends in the region, to the extent that it launched a media and propaganda campaign called the Struggle Against Creation of a Shia Crescent that turned into a public battle in many countries. The first arena was the formation of a bloody war in Iraq. The dramatic victories for Shia parties, which had good relations with Iran in various elections in the years that followed the fall of Saddam Hussein in Iraq, was a severe defeat for the rulers of Saudi Arabia as well as the U.S. Something needed to be done to stop these victories, and the creation of a religious war was Saudi Arabia's first choice. Al-Qaeda in Iraq, led by Abu Musab Zarqawi, started a bloody war in Iraq in which the main victims were civilians. All Iraqi cities were involved in a war for which no one could imagine an end. The explosion of Al-Askari Shrine in Samarra on June the 13th of 2007 escalated the conflicts in a way that 2006 and 2007 were the bloodiest years in Iraq after the fall of Saddam Hussein. Within these 2 years, dozens of people were brutally killed in different parts of Iraq every day. According to a research, nearly 60,000 people were killed in Iraq just in those 2 years.
Violence is not raging rampantly across Iraq.
My view would be they've reached a stage of desperation from their standpoint.
So the country is not awash in sectarian violence.
Americans have never retreated in the face of thugs and assassins, and we will not begin now.
According to WikiLeaks reports, in the early days of the Iraq War, only 7 al-Qaeda-linked groups were active in the country. The number of these groups increased to hundreds at the end of 2008. Most of the commanders of these groups were trained in different parts of the world with the support of Saudi Arabia years ago before they moved to Iraq. Iran tried to help reduce violence through mediation in Iraq, and to that end, it formally negotiated with U.S. officials based in Baghdad for the first time. After these negotiations, violence was significantly reduced. But a few years later, some events unfolded again in the Arab world that shifted the political balance to the detriment of Saudi Arabia in the region. On December the 17th of 2010, a Tunisian greengrocer, Mohamed Bouazizi, living in the capital, set himself on fire in front of the city hall to protest the confiscation of his goods and being beaten by a police officer. The incident sparked a major uprising in the country that ended the 23-year rule of Zain al-Abidine bin Ali. Bin Ali, a close friend of Saudi Arabia, fled to the kingdom. But the story did not stop in Tunisia. The wave of this uprising spread like a domino over other Arab countries such as Egypt, Bahrain, Libya, and Yemen, countries whose leaders had been close friends of Saudi Arabia for years. Saudi Arabia worked to stop these defeats, attempts to host the fugitive leaders of these countries, and also sending troops to protect some others were among some of their measures during those days. But an important policy on the agenda of Saudi Arabia and its allies was to move the battlefield to Syria. Transferring all terrorist groups with a Takfiri view to Syria and granting them unprecedented military, financial, and political aids under the Saudi management began to overthrow the ruling government in Syria. No solutions for peace talks or negotiations could be found due to Saudi Arabia's acts of sabotage. A few years after the outbreak of the war in Syria, then U.S. Vice President Joe Biden, in a speech at Harvard University, made some bizarre remarks about the war and the role of U.S. allies in Syria.
What my constant cry was that our biggest problem is our allies. Our allies in the region were our largest problem in Syria. The Turks were great friends, and I have a great relationship with Erdogan, which I just spent a lot of time with. The Saudis, the Emiratis, etc. What were they doing? They were so determined to take down Assad and essentially have a proxy Sunni-Shia war. What did they do? They poured hundreds of millions of dollars and tens of thousands of tons of weapons into anyone who would fight against Assad. Except that the people who were being supplied were al-Nusra and al-Qaeda and the extremist elements of jihadis coming from other parts of the world. Now, you think I'm exaggerating? Take a look. Where did all of this go? So now what's happening? All of a sudden, everybody's awakened because this outfit called ISIL, which was al-Qaeda in Iraq, which when they were essentially thrown out of Iraq, found open space and territory in eastern Syria, work with al-Nusra, who we declared a terrorist group early on, and we could not convince our colleagues to stop supplying them.
But Iran's presence in this country, due to the request of the Syrian government, changed the equations. The years-long war in Syria is not over yet, but today, no one is talking about the overthrow of Bashar Assad. The next battlefield was Yemen, where Saudi Arabia's efforts to rebuild its desired government had failed. Saudi Arabia entered Yemen directly with the formation of a coalition of some Arab countries and armed support from Western countries. Riyadh, worried that Yemen's Ansarullah movement, which tends towards Iran and the Islamic Revolution, would become a political military group in the Yemeni power structure, like Hezbollah in Lebanon. Despite a comprehensive land, sea, and air blockade of Yemen since the beginning of the war, which made it impossible to even send humanitarian aid to the country, Saudi Arabia has been trying to accuse Iran of secretly providing financial, educational, and equipment assistance to the Ansarullah movement, the government based in Sana'a, and the Yemeni People's Committee. A claim that is even hard for Saudi friends to believe.
This is the kind of weapon the Iranian regime and the Iranian IRGC, they are using against the civilian object and the civilian infrastructure. They have attacked the Saudi in last May and also the several days ago, 4 days ago. This UAV is Iranian UAV, Delta Wing, and all the component that we have recovered and we have analyzed through our expert. It shows the capability of the Iranian regime.
What is it about these missiles and UAVs that tell you specifically that they don't have the range to have been flown from Yemen?
The cruise missile cannot reach as we have put the ring, and it's not coming from Yemen. Those kind of attack is coming from the north with the capability that most likely from the north it can be launched from somewhere, and right now we are working to know exactly the launch point. I mean, your last point, please. Last point you mentioned?
Well, the last point was, how do you find, how are you finding that launch point?
As I mentioned, so we have a lot of way to find it and to spot it. And we got recovered a lot of information from the UAV itself. Some of the components here, the Iranian regime and the IRGC, they are trying to erase the information. However, we have collected the enough information and to know what's behind it. Thank you.
So is it Iran?
Thank you.
Is it Iran?
Thank you.
Would
you please, I need,
yes.
I am controlling the press conference. Have a seat, please. Please.
Thank you very much. Mark Stone from Sky News. With respect, this is quite an embarrassing display for the Saudi military, because it's quite clear that your air defences failed incredibly badly, that so many missiles and drones were able to penetrate deep into Saudi Arabia.
The recent decade has been the time of a cold war between Saudi Arabia and Iran. The coming to power of the new king, King Salman, and his arrangement of the pyramid of power increased tensions between the two countries. Many analysts considered the new crown prince, who was also the minister of defense, to be the most powerful person in the Saudi dynasty and the general designer of Saudi politics. In the days that we are making this documentary, 90 years have passed since the beginning of Iran-Saudi Arabia relations. The two countries have seen many ups and downs in their ties in all these years. And today, it is passing one of its most tense periods. Today, Saudi Arabia is very different from 90 years ago. The face of its cities has drastically changed. However, one thing still remains unchanged from the past century. Saudi Arabia's reliance on Kaaba and oil dollars. The story of relationships between Iran and Saudi Arabia is still ongoing. The story of two countries whose destinies are intertwined and their policies influence one another. The people of the future will also write about these days and the relationship.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
A U.S. winter storm has claimed at least 50 lives, over half in western New York. The dead have been found in their cars, homes, and in snowbanks. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Associated Press has covered this story and tells us more. The death toll from a pre-Christmas blizzard in much of the United States has risen to 50, according to authorities, with the number in western New York State alone hitting 27, as rescue and recovery efforts continued on Monday, 26th of December. The dead have been found in their cars and homes and in snowbanks, and some perished while shoveling snow. Rescue and recovery efforts from the days-long storm continued on Monday, 26th of December. On Friday and Saturday, in one of the worst-hit regions of the country, the blizzard roared through western New York, stranding motorists, knocking out power lines, and preventing emergency crews from reaching residents in frigid homes and residents stuck in cars. President Joe Biden said his prayers were with the victims' families, and on Monday, offered federal assistance to the hard-hit New York State. Huge snowdrifts nearly covered cars on Monday, 26th of December, and there were thousands of houses, some adorned in unlit holiday displays, that have been dark from a lack of electricity. The storm is expected to claim more lives because it trapped some residents inside houses and knocked out power lines to tens of thousands of homes and businesses. Scientists say the warming Earth may have contributed to the intensity of the winter storm. That's because the atmosphere can carry more water vapor, which acts as fuel, said Mark Cerise, director of the National Snow and Ice Data Center at the University of Colorado at Boulder. Victor Gensini, a meteorology professor at Northern Illinois University, likened a single weather event to a baseball match and a climate as your batting average. It's hard to say, Cerise said, but are the dice a little bit loaded now? Absolutely. There may be some relief this week from the extreme weather, which has stretched from the Great Lakes near Canada to the Rio Grande along the border with Mexico, as forecasters are calling for temperatures in the U.S. to slowly rise. There may be some relief this week from extreme weather, which has stretched from the Great Lakes in northern United States near Canada to the Rio Grande along the southern border with Mexico, as forecasters are calling for temperatures in the U.S. to slowly rise. In the meantime, the recovery work continues. About 60% of the U.S. population faced some sort of winter weather advisory or warning as temperatures plummeted drastically below normal from east of the Rocky Mountains to the Appalachians. On Monday, 26th of December, some 2,085 domestic and international flights were cancelled as of about noon Eastern Standard Time, according to the tracking site FlightAware. The site said Southwest Airlines had 1,253 cancellations, nearly a third of its scheduled flights and about five times as many as any other major U.S. carrier. An email to Southwest Airlines was not immediately returned, and the Dallas-based airline hadn't updated its website about the conditions since Saturday. Based on FlightAware data, there were from cancellations and delays at airports across the United States, including Denver, Atlanta, Las Vegas, Seattle, Baltimore, and Chicago. British newspaper The Guardian has covered the same story and tells us more. As Buffalo, New York reeled from a historic winter storm that left at least 34 people dead, first responders charged with the grim task of looking for more victims battled snowdrifts and sub-freezing temperatures. We've had so many bodies that various hospitals are full, and we're just having to go through and determine if the individuals have died from a blizzard-related death, Mark Poloncarz, executive of Erie County, New York, told CNN. The Buffalo Police Commissioner, Joseph Gramaglia, told reporters he expected more bodies to be found as snow was moved. Buffalo police had around 1,000 outstanding 911 calls, though some may be duplicates, he said. Police were fixing yellow crime scene tape on the side mirrors of abandoned vehicles that they had been checked for fatalities. This is painstaking and grueling work, Police Chief Joseph Gramaglia said. For many residents, immediate relief remained out of sight. Driving bans remained and many grocery stores were shuttered. Adding to the misery, after 4 feet of snow fell over Christmas, another 7.3 inches fell on Monday, 26th of December, bringing totals for the season to more than 100 inches of snow. Bob Oravec, a National Weather Service forecaster, said any additional snow Buffalo may have is going to be impactful. Late on Monday, Mark Poloncarz, executive of Erie County, New York, said the storm was the worst storm probably in our lifetime, even for an area accustomed to high snowfall off the Great Lakes. Among fatalities attributed to the storm, 3 people were found dead in their vehicles. 4 died without heat in their homes. 3 died from cardiac arrest and events relating to shoveling or other snow-clearing operations, and 3 died after emergency services were delayed. They have been found a number of different ways, a spokesman for the Buffalo mayor, Byron Brown, told the New York Times. They have been found in stranded vehicles, they have been found on sidewalks near street corners, some have been found in snowbanks. One victim, 22-year-old Andel Taylor, died after being trapped in her car for 18 hours in which she reportedly exchanged videos with her sisters in North Carolina. "We're certainly not blaming individuals who were driving," Brown said on Tuesday when asked about any failures in emergency response. "Our goal was to save everyone, to respond to every call, but the act of driving during a blizzard, during zero visibility and whiteout conditions, as you can surmise, made the emergency response much more difficult." Tales of hardship were common. Shahida Mohammed told WKBW an outage knocked out power to the ventilator used by her one-year-old son. She and the child's father manually administered breaths on Friday to Sunday when rescuers saw her social media posts. Mohammed said her son was doing well despite the ordeal. The New York governor, Kathy Hochul, told reporters this blizzard is one for the ages. Certainly, it's the blizzard of the century. Kathy Hochul also noted that the storm came a little over a month after a first historic snowfall and said the White House had promised a federal emergency declaration for Erie County, and Genesee County, making assistance available. President Biden said his prayers were with the victims' families. The two Democratic New York senators, Kirsten Gillibrand and Chuck Schumer, marked a once-in-a-generation blizzard.
Hidden Files.
But Cece never saw her husband's face again because her plane crashed that morning at 10:03. What took place on 9/11 was the deadliest attack on U.S. soil ever, which took the lives of almost 3,000 people. People whom some of their heartbreaking stories have been told and retold over and over again by mainstream media. But the greatest toll this incident took was neither on September the 11th nor in America. And that's where millions more heartbreaking stories are waiting to be heard. Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi, and today I'm here to share with you stories of the fall of people who had nothing to do with the 9/11 attacks. People who fell victim to the campaign that started following September 11th, a campaign named the War on Terror. Following the September 11th attacks, U.S. President George W. Bush declared a global military war on terror campaign. He called on world leaders to join the U.S. in this fight and said, "Every nation in every region now has a decision to make. Either you are with us or with the terrorists." Bush then stated how this war on terror was to unfold. "Our war on terror begins with Al-Qaeda, but it does not end there. It will not end until every terrorist group of global reach has been found, stopped, and defeated." Well, let's look at how a lot of these events unfolded. October the 7th, 2001, airstrikes were launched in Afghanistan by the U.S. and the U.K., followed by a ground offensive. Now, more than 240,000 Afghans were killed as a direct result. And then if we go forward to March the 19th, 2003, U.S. and coalition forces invaded Iraq, claiming that the country had weapons of mass destruction. More than 300,000 Iraqis were killed as a direct result. Today, the War on Terror campaign continues to be used as an excuse for bombing people from Afghanistan to Yemen. According to the Cost of War Project, by 2021, over 900,000 people had been killed in the War on Terror, and over 80 countries are currently being targeted by the War on Terror today. But was this War on Terror campaign a sudden decision in the aftermath of 9/11, or were the attacks used as an excuse to justify a full-fledged pre-planned war? Well, our first guest, Scott Ritter, who is a whistleblower and former intelligence officer, is here with us to discuss more.
Scott Ritter, United States Marine Corps intelligence officer, who was a chief weapons inspector with the UN in Iraq from 1991 to 1998. Mr. Ritter quit the inspections team in 1998. He became a whistleblower and a critic of the Bush administration's claims that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction.
Thanks so much for being with us, Scott, here on Hidden Files. I mean, can you explain your perspective exactly what the concept of war on terror means?
We were attacked on 9/11. Now, we can have a discussion about whether or not this was blowback from, decades of American malpractice and malfeasance in the Middle East. That's a fair point. But we did not invite this attack. We did not want this attack. We did not will this attack. We were attacked. And, you know, the world saw that and recognized that. That's why the world rallied behind the United States in the aftermath of 9/11, saying this was unwarranted, this was unjust, this was horrible, and we will support the United States. But they weren't willing to support the United States in carrying out a counteroffensive that went beyond simply punishing those who perpetrated the attack. And that's what the war on terror became. It wasn't about punishing Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. It was about American asserting dominance on an entire region, and indeed, by doing so, on the entire world. And that's what the war on terror was. It wasn't a war on terror. It was basically a war of regional and global domination by the United States using a horrible act of terrorism as justification.
Well, don't you feel that there was a plan to attack Iraq even prior to the September 11th attacks?
I think the Department of Defense had been heavily engaged with Iraq over the decade of the 90s, and that there were military contingencies in place that could have the United States defeating Iraq, occupying Iraq. These were plans. They weren't necessarily fully developed. The CIA would play a supporting role in that, but there is ample evidence that the United States had plans in the works for invading and occupying Iraq prior to 9/11.
Well, what are some of the lingering effects of the U.S. war on Iraq?
The war in Iraq has never ended. I mean, it continues to this day. The political instability that we see in Baghdad is a direct consequence of the decision by the United States to invade and occupy Iraq in 2003.
Well, do you think that the U.S. would have invaded Iraq even if the 9/11 attacks hadn't taken place, since Iraq really had nothing to do with those attacks anyway?
I think the events of 9/11 accelerated the inevitable military conflict between the United States and Iraq that had been brewing for over a decade since the end of Operation Desert Storm in 1991. The Clinton administration in 1998 had put in place a law that basically codified regime change as the official policy of the United States government. And the United States was moving toward a decisive confrontation with Iraq that would have occurred whether or not 9/11 took place. I think 9/11 accelerated this, but the American public was already pre-programmed to accept the notion that Saddam Hussein was an evil that needed to be confronted and destroyed. And they were unquestioning about the weapons of mass destruction narrative that was being put forward by the United States government well before 9/11.
Well, in your perspective, who benefited from the war?
I mean, the short-term benefit was getting rid of Saddam Hussein, who had proven to be a perpetual thorn in the side of multiple American presidential administrations. His continued survival was an embarrassment to the United States. But beyond that, the United States gained no benefit. This was a colossal failure. It was a failure from almost day one. We never won over the Iraqi people. We were always seen as an occupying force. And that notion of the American occupier flew in the face of what we were trying to promote, which is the role of the United States as a liberator, promulgating the model of American democracy as something that should be emulated regionally. Instead, we became the brutal occupier, and we turned the region and indeed much of the world against us. There's nothing positive that came out of America's precipitous invasion and occupation of Iraq.
Well, thank you so much for being with us right here on Hidden Files, Scott Ritter. Now, the war on terror was not limited to bombing locations claimed to be terrorist hotspots in different countries. It entailed control of countries and their resources. One example of such control was when Paul Bremer, an American diplomat, was deployed to Iraq, where he became the country's chief executive authority following the U.S.'s invasion. Now, he wanted to implement 100 different orders in Iraq through one of Bremer's orders. The Iraqi army was dismantled, also using Coalition Provisional Authority, CPA. Bremer changed the Iraqi constitution to benefit American authorities. For instance, CPA's draft included banning political parties opposed to the U.S.'s occupation from participating in elections. And so from the U.S. controlling any government that would come to be in Iraq to the country even losing autonomy over its seed bank for farming, every aspect of life in Iraq was affected. Neoliberalism was being infused throughout the country, and it wasn't the Iraqi people who were profiting. There was a major heist during the occupation on so many levels, from cultural artifacts being stolen to the national wealth of the country's oil being completely controlled by the U.S. to the billions of dollars that Western contractors won. Now, let's take a look at some of these contractors.
The number of contractors on the ground outnumbered U.S. troops most years of the U.S. occupation. American politicians were invested in the contractors. Many of them owned stocks in these contractors' companies. U.S. politicians had personal interests and stocks in these contractors. 51 congressmen and women, along with their spouses, owned between $2.3 and $5.8 million worth of stocks in the top 30 defense contractor companies. The Big Five, Lockheed Martin, Boeing, General Dynamics, Raytheon and Northrop Grumman, and some others acquired the next tier of manufacturers such as Hughes Aircraft and McDonnell Douglas. In the year to June 2020, the Big Five accounted for nearly a third of the $480 billion obligated by the Pentagon to defense contractors. Meanwhile, the defense sector spent over $2.4 billion lobbying Congress since 2001. These defense contractors make direct campaign contributions to most congressional members. 1. Lockheed Martin, total sales $46.5 billion, gross profit $2.7 billion. 2. Boeing, total sales $68.7 billion, gross profit $4 billion. 3. BAE, total sales $30.7 billion, gross profit $2.3 billion. 4. General Dynamics, total sales $32.7 billion, gross profit $2.5 billion. 5. Northrop Grumman, total sales $26.4 billion, gross profit $2.1 billion.
I'd like to welcome my next guest to the program, Dr. Ranjit Brar.
Ranjit Brar. Dr. Brar is a political analyst, a journalist, and a public speaker. He has been actively involved in the British anti-war movement for 30 years. Brahe regularly contributes to the workers' journals Proletarian and Lalkar. He is the author of Britain's Road to Socialism.
Thanks so much for joining me. Do you feel that there was a plan to attack Iraq prior to the September 11th attacks?
Well, I think the clearest indication that there was a pre-existing plan to attack Iraq prior to September 11th, 2001 was, of course, the fact that the original invasion of Iraq had taken place in 1990-1991 under George H. Bush. At that time, whilst Saddam Hussein was much weakened and Iraq was much weakened, and the oil for food program of quite draconian sanctions was installed upon Iraq, and famously Madeleine Albright, of course, at that time said it was worth the pain inflicted on the Iraqi people, in particular the 500,000 children who died of malnutrition and related diseases due to those sanctions. Madeleine Albright quite clearly said, yes, it was worth it. So there was obviously a pre-existing plan to invade Iraq. In terms of the 2003 invasion, there had been a plan. General Wesley Clark gave an interview in which he quite clearly said that around the 2001 attacks, when he was visiting Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz in the Pentagon, they'd clearly intimated him a plan not only to attack Iraq, but in fact the list of seven other countries in the immediate future.
Well, do you think the attacks were needed to use as justification for invading these countries?
In terms of whether 9/11, September 11, the attacks on the Twin Towers, Pentagon, and White House, because let's not forget it was all three sites that were initially attacked, were a useful justification. They were certainly used as a useful justification. Were they necessary to justify those acts of aggression by the United States? Personally, whilst they were clearly, you know, they pitched their media to a level of hysteria and hyperbole not seen before or since, and pivoted towards the war on terror as justification for all of their aggressive operations abroad. In fact, that was nothing new in a sense, and really the Monroe Doctrine since 1847 had declared, you know, U.S. a right to dominate the Western Hemisphere, the Americas, as their own territorial sphere of interest, as their own colony, their de facto colony, their zone to exploit. You know, it was in the aftermath of the collapse of the Soviet Union, really, that the United States and Bush, after Reagan, had really said there would be a new world order. This was the era in which America would be a world policeman, in which they would really come to now dominate the globe. And that unipolar moment, as we can call it, is a historical moment, has been continuing to this day. So was September 11th used by the United States establishment? Absolutely. Did they need that to justify their aggressive and hostile actions? Well, if you look at the American history, there have been perhaps 4 or 5 years in the total history of America when they've not been at war with one or another country. It's a country founded on genocide, essentially, and an empire founded upon ongoing bloodshed. There's not really been a single day's peace since the Second World War. America has been continual at war with other nations around the globe. So my personal feeling is that while they used it to their own advantage, they spun the media into a state of frenzy. They would have done exactly the same had September the 11th not occurred.
Who benefited from the war on Iraq?
That's a very good question. So the precise figures of the profits made by the U.S. state, and in particular U.S. companies, you know, are hard to calculate. They will certainly run into hundreds of billions and trillions of dollars, and that would be the direct looting of Iraq's oil, which was the fundamental reason for going into Saddam Hussein, of course, was threatening to flout U.S. diktat, no longer comply with producing the necessary quantities of oil at the necessary prices in the interests of the U.S., and rather was going to cooperate with OPEC. So they lost control of Saddam Hussein, and this very important Iraq has perhaps 10 to 15% of the world's proven oil reserves, as has other important countries, of course, including Iran and Kuwait, Saudi in the region. what were the other things they benefited from? So the war itself, the incredible military expenditure. US has a military budget of $850 billion per annum on military, more than enough to solve the vast majority of the world's problems in healthcare, in nutrition, and in housing. But of course, that money is not dedicated to solving those problems, but to reinforcing America's exploitation of the world and their exploitative position. But Lockheed Martin, Boeing, so many US defense contractors and companies made literally a killing, but absolute fortune in monetary terms from the war itself and from the sales of weapons to the American government, to the British government, to the coalition of the willing, so-called, and to other nations based on their testing of weapons on an army which, relatively speaking, you know, was absolutely unable to defend itself against this huge onslaught of the world's largest industrial powers under the NATO umbrella. In addition to that, of course, there were huge contracts for reconstruction and occupation of Iraq over an extended period of time. And given the size of the bases and contractors who still operate in Iraq, you can see that those profits and loot are ongoing. And of course, ultimately, all of the money to pay for all of those operations came, in addition to an extent from the American taxpayer, overwhelmingly from loot extracted from the Iraq. And that includes, incidentally, the confiscation of the gold bullion reserves of the central bank. So however you look at it, you know, this was an absolute, not even a neo-colonial, but a classical colonial operation of plunder, which meant that Iraq went from being one of the most prosperous countries on earth, more prosperous than most southern European nations, more prosperous than Spain, arguably more prosperous than Italy, certainly more prosperous than Greece, to being one of the poorest countries on earth where chaos still rules. And this is precisely, of course, the intended desire, because while that chaos rules, while the Iraqi people can't demand the repatriation of their oil wealth, that looting continues.
Can you explain the concept of war on terror and how it served those who instigated this concept?
The concept of the war on terror was a very useful device to find a new enemy to justify the reason for not only ongoing military expenditure, ongoing NATO alliance, but in fact its constant expansion. As we've seen, NATO has been expanding right up towards the borders of Russia and China. So global domination, in fact, was the name of the game. But that was portrayed, you know, as America was a victim, America was the great upholder of democracy, America would be the world's policeman. It was America's mission to go and impose, you know, democracy, the free market, and institutions of NATO, EU, and other military alliances, essentially that served their own military and economic machine. So this essentially was making the world safe for the penetration of American capital. But, you know, war after war after war was fought against people after people to stop them having independent governments that would put the interests of those nations first.
Well, thank you so much for being with us right here in Hidden Files. September 11th was indeed a tragic event, but thanks to mainstream media, what many don't realize is that the main victims of the 9/11 incident were not Americans. They were unarmed civilians. They were Iraqi families, unsuspecting of who may break into their homes. Other victims of 9/11 were women and children being terrorized in their homes, and many are still being born with signs of terror all over their bodies, with horrifying birth defects due to depleted uranium and other chemicals. Birth defects like they were killed, wounded, and uprooted, not in the thousands, but in the millions. And yet they were neither paid reparations, nor did they even receive an official apology. And more importantly, there has been no accountability for the crimes committed, as trillions of dollars have been spent to cause havoc and to line the pockets of those heavily invested in war and chaos. Well, Hidden Files will continue to bring your attention to what's going on with this war on terror that was declared 21 years ago and is still causing death and destruction around the globe. Now, that's it for me, Marzia Hashemi, and all the crew here on Hidden Files.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Amplified by climate change, extreme rainfall, wildfires, and pests are disrupting the natural patterns of bees. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Wrote in this regard, the extreme weather that has battered much of the U.S. in 2022 doesn't just affect humans. Heat waves, wildfires, droughts, and storms also threaten many wild species, including some that already face other stresses. Drought conditions in western U.S. in 2021 dried up bee forage, the floral nectar and pollen that bees need to produce honey and stay healthy. An extreme rain in Northeast limited the hours that bees could fly for forage. In both cases, managed colonies, hives that humans keep for honey production and commercial pollination, were starving. Beekeepers had to feed their bees more supplements of sugar water and pollen that they usually would to keep their colonies alive. Some beekeepers who had been in business for decades shared that they lost 50% to 70% of their colonies over the winter of 2021 to 2022. These weather conditions likely also affected wild and native bees. And unlike managed colonies, these important species did not receive supplements to buffer them through harsh conditions. One clear takeaway from this year's meeting was that climate change has become a new and formidable stressor for bees, potentially amplifying previously known issues in ways that scientists can't yet predict but need to prepare for. pollinators contribute an estimated $235 billion to $577 billion yearly to global agriculture, based on the value of the crops they pollinate. Understanding and mitigating the impacts of climate change on pollinators is key for supporting healthy ecosystems and sustainable agriculture. Bee health first attracted widespread attention in 2006 with the emergence of colony collapse disorder, a phenomenon where the majority of adult worker bees in a colony disappeared, leaving their honey and pollen stores and some nurse bees behind to care for the queen and remaining immature bees. In the past 5 years, reported cases have declined substantially. Now, researchers are focusing on what beekeepers call the four P's: parasites, pathogens, pesticides, and poor nutrition, as well as habitat loss for wild and native bees. One of the most severe threats to honeybees over the past several decades has been Varroa destructor, a crab-like parasite mite that feeds on honeybees' fat body tissue. The fat body is a nutrient-dense organ that functions much like the liver in mammals. It helps bees maintain a strong immune system, metabolize pesticides, and survive through the winter. These are vital functions, so controlling mite infestations is essential for bee health. Varroa can also transmit deadly pathogens to honeybees, such as deformed wing virus. Controlling mite populations is challenging. It requires using an insecticide in an insect colony, or, as beekeepers say, trying to kill a bug on a bug. It's hard to find a formula strong enough to kill mites without harming the bees. Monitoring varroa takes significant skill and labor, and mites can build up resistance to treatments over time. Researchers and beekeepers are working hard to breed varroa-resistant bees, but mites continue to plague the industry. Pesticides also harm bees, particularly products that cause sublethal or chronic bee health issues. Sublethal pesticide exposures can make bees less able to gather forage, grow healthy larvae, and fight off viruses and mites. However, it can be hard to document and understand sublethal toxicity. Many factors affect how bees react to agrochemicals, including whether they are exposed as larvae or an adult bees. The mixture of chemicals bees are exposed to, the weather at the time of application, and how healthy a bee colony is pre-exposure. Researchers are also working to understand how soil pesticides affect ground nesting wild bees, which represent over 70% of the U.S. native bee population. Like many other species, bees are losing the habitat and food sources that they depend on. This is happening for many reasons. For example, uncultivated lands are being converted to farmland or developed worldwide. Large-scale agriculture focuses on mass production of a few commodity crops, which reduces the amount of nesting habitat and forage available for bees. And many farmers often remove pollinator-friendly plants and shrubs that grow around farmlands to reduce the risk of attracting animals such as deer and rodents, which could spread pathogens that cause foodborne illness. Research suggests that these efforts harm beneficial insects and don't increase food safety. As diverse and healthy bee forage disappears, beekeepers feed their bees more supplements, such as sugar water and pollen substitutes, which are not as nutritious as the nectar and pollen bees get from flowers. Researchers don't know exactly how climate change will affect bee health, but they suspect it will add to existing stresses. For example, if pest pressures mount for farmers, bees will be exposed to more pesticides. extreme rainfall can disrupt bees' foraging patterns. Wildfires and floods may destroy bee habitat and food sources. Drought may also reduce available forage